to sleep, Mother. Go on, go to sleep.
And do me a favor. Don't disturb my friend. He's dead tired.
Well, what the hell are you saying, Doss? You've lost half your body sleeping.
I sleep pretty hard.
Welcome to Rock and Roll Bedtime Stories.
Hey, it's Brian.
And hey, that's Brian.
And hey.
Oh, I'm Murdoch.
And hey, this is Rock and Roll Bedtime Stories. Welcome to the show.
It's a fun little experiment we started years ago where you send us letters asking about rock and roll lore that you've heard rumors of. And then we do the research and report back. And you can do that. You can get involved. It's wearethestoryguys@gmail.com. Like Howard did. Howard writes the show with this question. My buddy showed me a photo the other day that seemed to be taken in the 70s and featured, listen to this, group of musicians: Eric Clapton, Robert Plant, Phil Lynott from Thin Lizzy, most of Bad Company, and other random rockers from the time. I'd never seen this before. I have no idea where it was from. Is this some internet deep fake, or is there a story about all these guys getting together that I've just never heard before? I've attached the photo for reference. Thank you, Howard. Do you know what he's talking about?
Yeah. Oh, Howard, what a great letter. Well, that is a real photograph.
Okay, it is. Okay, that's what I was going to ask you. If you can establish, yeah, this is real.
That's a real photograph, and it was a photo op with all these people together, and it was a charity project. And that's why you had those big hitters, heavy hitters in one photo.
Early 1980, but it's all part of a celebration for something that happened in 1979 called the International Year of the Child.
Right, and we have to do some non-rock history for this.
Can you define the acronym UNESCO? UNESCO?
Yes, I can, because I am a freaking nerd, and it has to do with music. So, of course, that is the United Nations Educational, Scientific, and Cultural Organization, Brian.
I am impressed that you could pull that out. Yes, so I didn't know much about this. I've heard the term UNESCO, but I did not realize that it's basically like the specialized arm of the UN that's for arts. And that's an oversimplification, but for right, our purposes, just know 1945, they figure out they need this arm of the United Nations, and they're basically trying to like pilot projects around education in places like Haiti. They move this sacred temple in Nubia to keep it from being destroyed, stuff like that. In 1959, they are the force behind this Declaration of the Rights of the Child, which is this like international document where they get all these countries to agree that it's important to, you know, be nice to kids.
This is like 20 years later, 79. I guess they just had some sort of celebration or revisiting of that document.
Exactly, right? Yeah. So the UN Secretary General at the time signs this proclamation making 1979 the Year of the Child, basically to like bring this back up in pop culture again. And I'd also to just point out that, like, you know, listen, we haven't solved the problem. Like, there's still parts of the world where kids have it bad, right? So there's events all over UN member countries throughout 1979 to honor and celebrate this.
How does the UN Secretary General get half of the roster of the rock and roll class of 1979 involved in this?
I've wondered this because I'm not exactly sure if he was just a big rock fan or if he was really super savvy or if he was just sort of both. But there's a separate effort taking place in 1979 that he's also involved with, and it pays off. And that is something we've definitely never talked about on the show before. That's the concerts for the people of Kampuchea.
Right. And those are benefit concerts for Cambodia that McCartney put on.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. And those were interesting. It was December of 79. They happened over 4 days at the Hammersmith Odeon. And you're talking about some heavy hitters there. The Pretenders, The Who, The Clash, Queen, Elvis Costello. Most famously, though, it's because it's the last Wing show ever.
I like this because this is Paul finally getting his charity legacy concert. Like, everybody else had one in the Beatles, except maybe for Ringo. John got his early in the 60s. George gets Bangladesh, of course. And so now Paul's like, oh, don't count me out. Count me in that number. So he gets a big assist, though, from this same UN Secretary General, who clearly understands the appeal of rock and roll to the people of the world. So I don't know if he was making room for other rock and rollers who wanted to do good or what, but in this same time frame when he's doing this project with McCartney, his influence and connection to that children's cause brings together that list of folks mentioned up top in Howard's letter, and they all donate a track to a compilation so that it can be sold and the proceeds can go back to UNESCO. Classic charity album infrastructure there. And they get together to do some promotion for it and help sell it, and that, Howard, is what the picture is from.
That's right. And here's some artists on the track list of the Summit compilation for The Year of the Child. So, Howard, ready? ELO, Wings.
Oh,
Jerry Rafferty.
Love
him. We talked about him on the show.
Yeah,
Dire Straits, Eric Clapton, Elton John, Cliff Richard, Supertramp, Thin Lizzy, Yes, Pink Floyd, Bad Company, and as they say in Cheech and Chong movies, Led Zeppelin.
And that's noteworthy. Why is that noteworthy?
Because Peter Grant doesn't let them license their songs to anything.
They used to be famous for that.
Richard Linklater, if you don't know him from anything, you know him that he was the director of Dazed and Confused. And the soundtrack for that was phenomenal with the Water Tower Party and the whole shebang. Like all that, even it was in the 70s, felt like my high school. But he wanted to get a Zeppelin song in the soundtrack, and it was no dice. So when he was working on The Sound of Rock, he literally asked Jack Black to basically beg Led Zeppelin to license the Immigrant Song. So Jack Black, there's a video on YouTube where he shot a video of himself pleading along with a theater full of extras who are screaming, and they're doing the Immigrant Song, which is how the Immigrant Song ended up in School of Rock.
So this leads to another layer of Howard's question, right? How in the hell did Led Zeppelin get involved with this? And where does this compilation come from? If they're not a band that normally allows themselves or their music to be used this way. So when I stumbled on that detail, when I started down that rabbit hole, that's when I knew we had a story. Because you might be listening and be like, dude, you're like less than 5 minutes in and you've answered Howard's question. Yes, the picture's real, Howard. But the more interesting thing about this is that this is less about a particular comp or these particular artists. And this kind of becomes a story about a particular period and a particular entity inside the music biz, because this compilation came out on KTEL Records.
1979 Summer of the Sounds from KTEL Records.
Ba-ba, ba-ba, ba-ba. It's and all the same guy. We'll talk about who that is, but the voice on all those commercials, all the same guy.
Oh my gosh, I know everything about all of this that we're going to talk about, Howard, that Brian, we're going to talk about this today. I know about the guy, and KTEL was the king of the compilations for me. Brian, I think, was a Time Life
I was
person.
A Time Life guy. You were a KTEL guy, and that's just an age gap thing.
It's just an, and it's interesting because the TV commercials would be like, they'd have like a Seals and Crofts song on it and then Kiss. Like none of it was just kind of all over the place. And eventually at some point you'll get to now that's what I call yada yada. And we'll talk about that. But I found my favorite KTEL record ever. And it's, I threw it in the show notes. It's from 1984 and they have it up on Spotify. It has everything on it from the original record, except for Electric Avenue by Eddie Grant. So, and it's like one of my favorite records I ever listened to.
So if we're going
to hi-ho, KTEL,
if we're going to do this deep dive, we are leaving the regular world of rock stars that we normally spend our time in. And we're talking instead about a very innovative and inventive businessman, a Canadian guy who grows up in the 1930s in the wild part of Canada. And I say that because the lore has it that he used to trap weasels and sell them. When he starts to get interviewed, this is the story he will tell to sort of explain his work ethic, which is crazy. And I heard this story about trapping weasels, and I realized I don't know that I know what a weasel looks like. Do you know what a weasel looks like? I had to Google it.
I Googled it, yeah.
His name is Philip Kivas.
That's right. The infomercial guy.
100% He's the infomercial guy.
And I had, and for me, like, this guy smells like Ray Kroc. Like, when you know much about McDonald's and how Ray Kroc was running around, like, trying to hawk all these things before he ever figured out he needed to buy real estate to sell McDonald's restaurants. I had no curfew for watching TV as a kid, ever, for anything. So I watched everything. I watched it until the local channels went to the national anthem and then went to snow. I watched the live feed of the WWF on Madison Square Garden. So, man, I know everything about infomercials, like once they actually started becoming a thing. And so imagine my excitement when the infomercials are about records I wanted to buy.
Yeah, yeah. And we'll get to that crazy transition, the thing he figures out in the 70s. But first, this guy spends the early years of his adulthood doing door-to-door sales. Have you ever bought anything from a door-to-door salesman?
So as an adult, no. But as a kid, I watched a vacuum come in the house, demoed, purchased, and I straight up have seen someone walk in with a whole damn thing of encyclopedias when we bought them.
Oh,
so that happened.
That I was here about that, but I don't think I ever saw that happen. My family was always too tight, and also I don't know if we were letting people in the house to try to convince us of things. We were skeptical of the Jehovah's Witnesses, you know. So yeah, we was
but like, I wanted to like take off all my clothes and jump in the mashed potatoes when an entire like 26 plus however many other volumes of the encyclopedia came, because that was it, man. We didn't have computers. It was all it was like textbooks,
right?
But not the shitty ones at school. They were like 20 years old.
Yeah, but they were shiny, and there was a lot to look at. I get it. It's a lost thing. Like, we don't think about it anymore. We totally take all that for granted because it's at our fingertips now. That used to be right. The way you would get it. You'd either go to the library or somebody would sell it to you on the front steps. So this guy spends the early years of his adulthood doing door-to-door sales and like odd jobs. And at some point in his 30s, he goes to Atlantic City from the deep of Canada. He's in the U.S. and he sees something he'd never seen before. He sees boardwalk street barkers.
Oh, man. Okay. So Coney Island, they have boardwalk street barkers, kind of like guys coming to get you to play games. My favorite part are the more contemporary ones. And they're the ones that are behind the game with the microphone, and the entire time they're getting ready to try to get people to play, they're just spitting rhymes. They're kind of like working out rhymes in between games. So you're walking by and there's like a 16-year-old like potential hip hop star that's just spitting rhymes, getting ready for you to like go and throw those like little tiny hoops over the bottles.
It's so a specific skill set.
Win a comb.
It is a certain persuasion that goes with
step
it.
Step right up and get a plastic comb.
And
get a plastic thing.
There's a certain sort of delivery. I mean, you're onto something here. And I think we've talked about this before, but one of my best friends sold ShamWows this way for a while. He was at lived in a touristy town, and there was an outdoor shopping space. Apparently, depending on your phase of life, the money is not bad if you are really good at doing it. But this guy, Kivas, he's been doing door-to-door sales anyway, so he gets these tactics. Like, he just understands it. So here is Kivas' genius plan, plain and simple. He understands scale, right? So there's this math equation that all sales managers do about how many cold calls you need to make. I don't know if you've been in sales departments.
Yes.
You've done this.
Sure.
Yep. And he inherently gets that sales math. He just understands, like, if I do this many, if I tell this many people this many people percentage will say yes and blah, 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 blah. So it's very simple if you get that sort of sales math to say, okay, if I go from one door to the next, I'm talking to one person at a time, I'm giving the same speech over and over. If I'm on the boardwalk at Atlantic City and I'm talking to 10, 20, 30, 40 people at a time in a crowd, my hit rate is a lot better. I make more money. And then he moves back to Canada. He's got this new skill set, and he's like, wait a second. It's the 1960s. Everybody I know is getting this thing called the television. What if I could do this on TV?
And this is an interview from him, and it's later. It's 78. And this is what he said. I had heard of people here and there who were beginning to use television to demonstrate products. And I said, well, if that's the case, instead of pitching to a dozen people at a time, I can work to 1,000 people at a time on television.
Okay. But here's the thing. He needs a product, right? He's a salesperson. He doesn't really, it's not the passion for the product. He just needs something to sell.
Yes. So Howard, enjoy this squirrel rabbit hole wherever we're going, but it's purposeful. We're going to a very unrock and roll place for a minute. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Corporate Chemical Lab in 1938, New Jersey.
But to keep us thinking about music while we take a detour into science, because I don't want to get too far off course. That leads to very bad reviews on iTunes. Let me help you imagine what music they might have been listening to whilst working inside this chem lab, okay? 1938, New Jersey. Hopefully they've got some sort of radio device. Historically, there's a good chance that year they were humming along to the Andrew Sisters, one of my favorites.
Yep.
Ella Fitzgerald, maybe Bunny Berrigan. Personally, I'm just going to, as we tell this story, I would like for you to imagine that at the exact moment that this happens, the low strains of "You Must Have Been a Beautiful Baby" by Bing Crosby are undergirding the action inside the laboratory. So with that scene set, go forth.
Regardless of this soundtrack, it is inside this lab on the morning of April 6, 1978. There's a guy named
1938.
Roy. 1938, sorry. Roy J. Plunkett and his research assistant, Jack Reebok, fail doing an experiment. They're trying to make a refrigerant. And as they're getting things set up for the day, they realize that one of the cylinders where they had captured some gases, the things had solidified into a weird powder.
And so they play with this powder and they realize it has some weird properties. Namely, it doesn't corrode and it can withstand really high heat and it has low surface friction. And if you're like, what the hell does that mean? Basically, it means things don't stick to it.
Right. So at this period in history, what is the natural thing to do with a new chemical compound? You ship it over to the government so they can try to create atomic weapons. That's what I always do. It literally gets used for the Manhattan Project to help cut down on corrosion in specific storage situations.
Okay.
No lie.
So just quick recap. Guy screws up an experiment in the lab, creates this thing, that this chemical compound where when you rub it on stuff, things don't stick to it. And so he just sends it to the government and they start using it to try to create an atomic weapon. Okay. That's where we are. And then in 1954, a French engineer named Marc Grigiore gets some of this chemical compound that's officially known. At the time, they have a name for it. It's polytetrafluoroethylene, PTFE.
Yeah.
Man, that was a mouthful. For this project he's working on, he uses it because someone has told him about it. And they're trying to make fishing rods. And they have on the assembly line the mold for the fishing rod. And they need to be able to pull the fishing rod out easily. So they're going to put this on so it won't stick, right? So he goes home, and he's telling his wife about the boring stuff he does at work all day. And the story goes that she says something to the extent of, how about you do something useful and use some of that nonstick chemical to make it easier for me to cook and feed your fat face? And that's supposedly how PTFE gets put on frying pans.
That's 54, but it takes the rest of the decade for this product to get to North America. And while people who know about it are pretty impressed, there aren't many people who know about it. So enter our boy, Philip Kibas.
So he saw this frying pan at Macy's because he goes and gets a job selling there for a while in the store. And so once he's back in Canada, he's now A, seen this crazy frying pan, B, picked up these skills on how to bark at people and get them to buy stuff, and C, figured out that with television, he would have access to a lot of people at once, and he wants to put all of that crap together, right? And this is what he decides to do. He gets the company who makes those pans to let him pitch them in a live TV spot. He buys 5 minutes, and it works. There's a rush on local stores in his area of people trying to buy those no-stick frying pans.
Problem is, this particular pan manufacturer was very terrible at getting the coating to actually stay on the pan, of course. And plenty of these damn pans got returned as defective. It's like now. But as far as Kibas was concerned, the cat was out of the bag, and he could sell things on TV. So there's a knife that cuts through chicken bones. He sells millions of these in Australia. And later, there's the Vegematic and the Brush-O-Matic. Do you hear all these things? These are all the sounds of all the things that you sell on TV. He gets a radio DJ from Winnipeg called Bob Washington to voice all the spots. So you have the same guy doing all the spots and creates all the catchphrases. The ones like, but wait, there's more. And he takes the K from Kibas, the T from television, and he calls his company KTEL. There it is.
When I learned about this guy, I was reminded of this conversation that gets captured in the book The Everything Store by Brad Stone. And that book is about Jeff Bezos. But the story that it's told is that early in Amazon's history, someone from the book industry accuses Bezos of trying to bring down bookstores. And he points out that his interest is not about books at all. Like, he's not like, I'm not out here trying to sell books. I'm about trying to get a customer what they want in a quick and efficient way. And books are a good place to start because they're small and easy to ship. And so this obviously leads to Amazon. And I hear a lot of Kibas in Bezos in that sensibility, right? It's about the power of the medium and not the product.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Yeah. So I realize if you are a first-time listener to this podcast, you may be asking yourself, why the hell do we call this a rock and roll show? Because we have been talking about science and salesmanship. But wait, there's more.
Because in 1965, one of the products he gets the rights to promote in Canada is a vinyl record with a whole bunch of country songs on it. And presumably, he just starts poking around on how to get access to get the song works, right? And he discovers something.
He discovers that record companies had not yet figured out that there was a value to their back catalog. So he could go to the record guys and say, look, let me have access to these songs. We'll do a licensing agreement, 2 to 4 cents each. And then you'll be able to show your bosses that you're squeezing money out of assets that they think they've already used. It's like going into the garbage and pulling out plastic bags and using them again, right? They now have a way to re-monetize stuff in the catalog.
Right. It takes, of course, a non-record business guy to see this whole other side of the record business. He is convinced that he can combine the idea of value, i.e. multiple songs, with generalized appeal, betting that most people care about a sound than a particular song maker.
Yeah, so we should note that technically Kivas is not the first guy to do this. So there's an early radio pioneer. You and I are radio nerds. You probably remember this guy, Art LeBeau. And he'd been toying with this idea of compilations to highlight music from the 40s. And he was doing this just like 10 years after, right? So like late 50s, he's doing this. And he's the man responsible for the phrase oldie but a goodie. But
no.
Kivas takes it a step further. He connects different dots. And he takes the emotional attachment to the music out of the equation. So LeBeau was a radio guy, right? He was a music guy. He was thinking about the music part of it. Kivas was thinking about the math because he's a sales guy. So while Kivas's empire starts as a Canadian thing, once he starts taking this idea of compiling songs together, he's really hungry to try to break into the US market. And I don't know if you are going to be able to guess this, but he finds a particular format that does really well for his initial jaunt in the United States. Do you know what it was?
I do, but I'm going to allow you to have the honors to say it out loud.
It was polka.
That's right.
So just to give you some perspective on how successful this was, when right. he does 25 country hits, they print 180,000 copies and they sell them all. When he does 25 polka greats, he sells 1.5 million copies of it.
Yeah. Get your head around that. Like, what the hell is up with that? So this sets the stage for a whole slew of collections. 60 flashback greats of the 60s, Superbad, which has the theme from Shaft, 24 great truck driving songs, and 24 tearjerkers. You see where we're going with that. Those are all the kinds of compilations that are being put together.
And lots of things are being done here that make the KTEL collections unique in both the way they're produced and the way that they get presented. Now, notice that most of the collections include a number in the title, because one of the things they want to emphasize here is quantity.
Oh, yeah. It's all about the quantity. And because of that, the audio quality, a little lacking. To physically have room for all these songs, the record grooves were too close together, and sometimes songs would just get cut off or they would get trimmed off for time. And I remember a little weird edits when I was a kid where I'd have records and they didn't sound as good as the other records. Totally remember that.
For sure. In this
model, you're cramming songs on the records.
Cramming. And it works better early because 50s and 60s tunes are short. So when they – and polka songs, presumably, right? Shorter songs. So when they – are doing that, it's a little easier to really up the quantity deal. But it gets harder as they get deeper into compiling 70s hits because, you know, album-oriented rock, that stuff gets long. But even if they're a little lacking, they're cheap. $4.99 for all of these songs. Way less expensive than buying 24 7-inch singles. And remember, there's no other way to get a collection of songs. In a streaming playlist culture, it's hard to imagine. But you literally couldn't get songs separately unless you bought the singles and played them back-to-back.
Yeah, and that's the thing. The way that Kivas sold frying pans and knives and the way he sold music was exactly the same.
Exactly the same.
It was about the value, and it involved that same guy's voice yelling, that wait, there's more. So he had the same voice guy selling
It literally was not different. Like, that's the thing to emphasize here. Remember what I said. He was a sales guy. He didn't have an emotional attachment to this. So he's selling it exactly the same way he sold the Vegematic. And the other key component here that you're getting at has to do with physical location. So depending on how well you remember KTEL dominance in the 1970s, you may be confusing these commercials and this whole concept with something Murdoch mentioned up top, which is something close to my heart, the Time Life compilations, which I was listening to one today. Time Life will follow this structure into the 80s and 90s, but they'll do it with mail order. Okay, so that's a lot of what you might remember depending on your age is now call this number, make a certain number of payments on your credit card, et cetera, et cetera.
Columbia House.
Right. Yeah. But that's not what KTEL is doing. KTEL is advertising the compilation, but they're distributing them in stores.
Yes, that's right. I could buy a KTEL record in my hometown of 8,000 people, where we didn't have a record store, a clothing store, or a bookstore. But we did have drugstores, department store drugstores, and hardware stores that would just have a section of, like, other stuff. And it would have records. Totally weird. Music for the masses. And trust me, this is how I got my records. And it was weird when you would be, as a kid, I would be in one of these stores talking to an employee at one of these stores about a compilation record that I was interested in buying, and I'm not talking to a record store person, right?
You're talking to a guy who's also selling you screws.
Or crescent wrenches, right?
Right. Just,
yeah.
So this, by the mid-70s, becomes the way the middle of the country gets stuff, right? The way of selling things becomes so ubiquitous that for a lot of people, you probably most remember a joke version of this. And I know you remember the joke version of this. Saturday Night Live's infomercial version?
Oh, yeah, yeah. Where Aykroyd, he literally takes a fish. And it's the Super Bassomatic 76. And he literally takes a fish and puts it in a blender.
Oh, my
and
God.
And it blends the fish, which I don't know if you can do that now. I mean, dead fish. The best part about it is Lorraine Newman has this glass that comes from the pitcher and she drinks it. And she goes, that's real bass.
Oh, man. That brings us to the end of the 70s and to what gets us very close to the pinnacle of KTEL's reign. And it does, all puns intended, include that charity album, The Summit. So just to sort of to put a bookmark here for a second and just point, like, we're now to where this Led Zeppelin agrees to be on this compilation moment happens. Because it doesn't matter how big a band you are. This is how music is getting sold to the middle of America. One thing that made me think of was, I mean, I lived in Arkansas for a long time. And you bought records in Arkansas at Walmart. And there was a period where in the middle of the country, and I mean, this is in the 90s and in the early 2000s, in the middle of the country, that was what you did. I lived where Walmart was based out of. And Walmart was like the number one music retailer in the country in the early 2000s. And so they had this power where they would have meetings in their home base in this little area in Arkansas that didn't house that many people, but they would fly all their shareholders in and they would bring in the biggest names in music. They would show up because this was how you sold records. Beyonce would sing the national anthem. I mean, it was just wild stuff. The biggest names you've ever bought. Bon Jovi would show up and sing, and like they'd be there for 5 minutes and leave, and they would have gotten flown in because this was how you sold records. So before this, at the end of the 70s, you sold records with KTEL. KTEL was selling records to people who weren't on the coasts and in big cities. They were selling to Mark Murdoch at a hardware store in Lewisburg, Tennessee. And so you did stuff with KTEL. So part of the answer to the question about how do all these people get coerced into doing this, it's part of the music business.
By this point, larger record labels were getting wise to what KTEL was up to and wanted to cash in themselves. While it seems bizarre to see Led Zeppelin on one of these, I dug up this article from the 1975 issue of Circus, my favorite magazine. And the article says, "Tube turns heavy metal to gold," which is really funny. So with a combined catalog including such metal, mighty metal works as Zeppelin, Uriah Heep, Black Sabbath, MC5, Alice Cooper, and Jimi Hendrix to choose from, the special products division of Warner Elektra Atlantic decided to throw hard rock fans a specially priced bone in the form of a 2-record anthology labeled aptly enough Heavy Metal. And thank goodness my sister had a copy of it because
I saw that
as a kid.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, man. The most I can really dig up is that there was a direct connection between Swansong, which is Zeppelin's imprint record label distributed by Atlantic, and the creation of the Summit compilation. I think they had done this together. Meaning, not only did Zepp, the band that never licenses and collaborates, did they do it here, they did it with KTEL. So it's just back to that point of this was how business was being done.
And there's a piece in the show notes from 0 to 180 that outlines that many compilations over this time period that Led Zeppelin actually ends up on. They were more free with their partnerships than you might think, but most were part of the Warner Special Products line, not the Philip Kivas Yell from the TV Special KTEL Records line.
Well, think what you want about the quality of the product at KTEL, but by the early 1980s, it was pretty hard to deny their presence. They had sold 500 million record albums, and there's a point where they racked up number 1, 3, 4, and 5 albums on the charts in Britain.
And Kivas gets pretty powerful on the way to this point. He will tell stories of working directly with Elton John, Perry Como, and is on the record as saying, "Liberace took me to his house and made dinner for me and my wife," which I would consider that to be kind of badass too.
So, as you might expect, if anyone is having this kind of success, plenty of other folks come along to imitate. All right. So Suffolk, Candlelight Records, TV Records, Columbia House, which you mentioned, and which, of course, morphs into this mail order thing that I was very, very entranced by as a young child. There's a great piece in the show notes from October of 1980 that ran in the Washington Post, and it focuses on the cottage industry that gets created here. Lots of interesting tidbits. If you're into this story about the business side of music from that period, I highly recommend you reading it. But one of the tidbits in there is that some of these folks would sell over TV with a cash on delivery option, and it typically led to a lot of losses, which,
yeah,
duh, but I can't believe they did that.
I just, as a kid, I don't think I knew for a long time what COD meant, but like it would be on the screen.
Right.
It would have COD and have the address, a PO box number, like totally weird, you know? But as you can probably guess, that eventually the big record labels are going to catch up on this model being perpetuated via technology with their own catalogs being used against them because record music industry douchebags. And so one day, Richard Branson and his team at Virgin, they're brainstorming on how they could benefit further from all the hits they own. And they conceptualize this partnership between their label and another one, EMI.
And they figure that just the pure star power of these two rosters would allow these two labels to create a compilation album that cuts out the middleman. How do we get KTEL out of this, right? Instead of licensing to them, couldn't we just be doing this and getting the royalties directly? And they decide to try it, but they don't know what to name it. And this story really made me laugh. So they've been sitting around trying to figure out what they're going to name this new endeavor, what they're going to name these albums that they're going to put out with all these songs on it. And Richard Branson has apparently been creeping on this chick that he's sort of obsessed with.
Yeah. So back to the lore that we like to discuss in this show. The lore around this is Richard Branson, before he went to space, had taken to decorating his houseboat with vintage signs. The sentence that screams bachelor with too much money. And this either leads to, or was due in part to the fact that he had a little crush on this woman who worked in an antique store in the neighborhood who had signs.
And at some point while he's in there creeping on this woman, he finds this sign he thinks is really funny. And it was a Danish ad for bacon from the 1920s. And it just had this pig depicted as listening to a chicken sing. When I heard this, it reminded me of the Chick-fil-A Eat More Chicken ads from a while back. That's the concept, I think.
Right. So Branson buys his poster. Instead of putting it on his houseboat, he gives it to his business partner to hang in his office because, quote, he was notoriously grumpy before breakfast and loved his eggs in the morning. So I bought him the poster, framed it, and hung it behind his desk. So when they were trying to name these new compilations, they look up and see
this poster.
And on that poster from the 1920s, the pig is commenting on the chicken singing. And it says, in a speech bubble, I presume, "Now that's what I call music."
And that's the end of K-Tell. That's it. That's the frickin' end of K-Tell. They just get frickin' stabbed in the face.
Oh, right, my God. So
eventually, K-Tell will buy one of their competitors, which is Candlelight, and actually get stuck holding the ticket when a ton of folks won't pay up money that they owe. And meanwhile, Kivas has been putting his money in diverse places, namely real estate and oil. It's not working out like he had initially hoped.
And in 1984, the U.S. division of K-Tell Records files Chapter 11. And in 86, the same thing happens to the Canadian branch. But here's the thing. If you've learned anything about Kivas, this dude only has one way to operate. He is a hustler. And he keeps being Kivas. We've established that he had a defining characteristic, and it was figuring out how to figure it out. And so he will wrestle back control of the company from the bank in the next few years. He'll get it back into shape in the 90s. And then the streaming era shows up, and he realizes he's in excellent shape. Mm-hmm. Because guess who owns a whole bunch of classic songs from the 50s and 60s that now need to go on streaming platforms?
That guy.
That guy.
And on top of that, he arguably redesigns the way that people listen to and discover music and leaves a giant legacy. One, an example, in 2013, Dave Grohl gave a keynote speech at South by Southwest praising K-Tell for exposing him to music early in his life, specifically Frankenstein by the Edgar Winter Group. Grohl told the crowd earnestly that the song's inclusion on a 1975 K-Tell Records blockbuster compilation, the first one he ever owned, was the record that changed his life.
Now, I have a feeling that a lot of people listening to this are having this moment, whether they may be in a room by themselves, they may be driving down the road, they may be running, they may be at the gym, and they're thinking, oh my God, what about this K-Tell record? What about that K-Tell record? My favorite one was this. We want to hear your stories. Like Murdoch has shared his. He has his favorite K-Tell. I know that there are a lot of people who have a specific one that was their gateway drug, right? So please send us an email. We are the story guys at gmail.com. Tell us about the K-Tell comp that got you into music. Because I love these stories, these origin stories, just like Dave Grohl. Imagine if he hadn't gotten, because where did he grow up? Like Virginia or something, right?
Yeah, he grew up East Coast. And the thing is that even though you might think, like, well, man, that was 40, 50 years ago, that K-Tell record thing. Yeah, man, we'll Google it. Like, people have it. People have copies of it.
Dude, or you people can get really into this. People get really into K-Tell. So this is what the research taught me. There was a website, and it's in the show notes, I think, where I don't know if I ended up using much off of it, but this guy is so into K-Tell that he has come up with a formula for ranking K-Tell compilations. And he's got like numbers, and he's got a key, and he like explains like if it has this many songs that had this much chart success, then it's categorized as this level of record. Like, people get really into the K-Tell thing. So by all means, indulge yourself if it is something you're interested in. The other thing I wanted to point out is I went to buy something for my wife recently at a pharmacy. And at this, you know, corporate chain pharmacy, it was a Walgreens, no free ads, I cannot find, the website tells me the item is there, and I can't find it. And so I finally go and find someone in the back of the store, and I'm like, you know, the website right here says you've got two of these, and I can't find it. And she goes, oh, that's because it's in our As Seen on TV section.
Oh.
That's still a thing. They have them at CVS and Walgreens and Walmart. Like, there is an As Seen on TV section. This still exists in 2024.
And it's like the stuff you would be like, sham wow, but it's the music.
Yeah, I mean, this, just because you're probably like, what the hell were you buying in the As Seen on TV section? These are gloves that help with joint pain. My wife has a chronic disease. So, like, and it works. They have been very helpful. So it's wild, and we have Philip Kivas to thank for all of that. So, again, we are the story guys at gmail.com. share your KTEL story or your As Seen on TV story or your Bass-O-Matic story. Real bass.
Real bass.
And get involved in the show on Patreon. Patreon.com/rockandrollbedtimestories. Your support means everything to us, and it allows us to get the show out to more people and to continue to create. So if you have $5 or $10 a month you can spare and send our way, we'd love it. Patreon.com/rockandrollbedtimestories. Of course, we'll make it worth your while with a bunch of free content. And Instagram.com/rockandrollbedtimestories. And wearethestoryguys.com is our home base online. So
hey now.
If you've got to wait until next week to meet back up with us, what should you keep doing until then, Murdoch?
Just keep telling stories.
Rock and Roll Bedtime Stories is a Story Guys production. The show is produced and edited by Brian Eichenberger. Get more stories, hear more podcasts, and book the guys for your conference or house party at wearethestoryguys.com. Copyright Boy Have We Got Stories Productions. All rights reserved.